So the Four Noble Truths of Buddha. He sat through the night. The story is that he sat through the night, and in the morning, he gazed at the morning star and was filled with understanding, which he then shared with those who he'd been practicing with before. And this is his first sermon that he gave. And the first thing to say is that they're always called the Four Noble Truths, but it's important to understand what that means, because it doesn't mean that it's truths that are noble. Another way of interpreting the Sanskrit that this comes from, or the Pali that this comes from, is that they are the truths that make a human being noble. That's what it is. So it's not the truths that are noble, but they're the truths that make a human being noble. And there's a kind of reflection in later teachings, in that there's in Mahayana Buddhism, there's the ways to wake up a great person, the ways to awaken someone. So it's similar. It's guidelines for awakening us rather than the truths that should be worshipped. So the first truth is the truth of dukkha. And dukkha is often translated into English as suffering. It's not. I don't think it's quite the right suffering. Quite the right translation, because it kind of encompasses more than that. It includes suffering, but it encompasses more than that. Dukkha means a sense of dis-ease, a sense of dissatisfaction, and some of that can be from real suffering in life, real suffering that life throws at us. The death, illness, infirmity, these things that life throws at us, death of friends, death of relatives, death of loved ones. And so it includes this real suffering, but it also includes more everyday dissatisfaction. That's the thing, it's not only this deep suffering, but also everyday dissatisfaction, which just makes us kind of not quite okay with life, not quite accepting what life's throwing at us. And it's basically that there are things that we want, and we don't quite get them. They pass us by, or we get them and then we lose them again. So all these are kind of sense. And there's even a sense of suffering. It says in Buddhism that having what you do want also creates suffering, because there's the fear of losing it again. So you can't escape this kind of dissatisfaction, the desire to have something that you don't have, the desire to get rid of something that you are uncomfortable with, the desire to keep those things which you like, and the fear of losing those things as well. All of this can lead to a sense of dis-ease in the mind that we all live with. And from a Buddhist point of view, one of the greatest, basically this dis-ease comes from a sense of a mismatch between our idea of how we would like reality to be and how reality is. That mismatch causes this dis-ease. We create constructions of how we would like the world to be, and the world never lives up to those constructions. We never live up to those constructions that we make, and that those constructions cause us this suffering. And one of the key, again from a Buddhist point of view, one of the key aspects of this is that we create an image of ourself. We create an image of ourself of how we believe we are, and we believe that image is something that is eternal, everlasting. You know, if we kind of quizzed on it, we wouldn't necessarily say that. We wouldn't say, oh, you know, I'm going to live forever. But there's a part of us that actually doesn't really believe that how we are is not going to persist forever. There's a part of us that doesn't really believe that, even though intellectually maybe we can accept this. It's part of us that really doesn't believe it. And so we kind of cling on to these ideas of how life should be, of how we are, and how we can grasp something, we can grasp some ideal and hold on to it forever. And that's what causes this dissatisfaction in life. So that's what the first noble truth is. If we see this suffering, see this nature of dissatisfaction in ourselves and observe it, then we become, we encounter the first noble truth, the fact that this dissatisfaction is always present within us, in our everyday lives. So that's the first truth. The second truth is, where does this suffering come from? And I've already touched on that when I've been talking about the suffering. And what the Buddha said, he used the word thirst to describe it. It's the thirst for the thirst for something which we don't have. It's the desire for something which we don't have, or the desire to keep something that we do have. And it's not, this is very important, because some people believe that Buddhism is a very kind of denial, a philosophy or religion of denial. It's not that we cannot enjoy or take pleasure in things. That is not the problem. The act of taking pleasure or enjoyment in something is not the problem. The problem is that that pleasure and enjoyment can result in us chasing after things or running away from things. That's what it is. So it's the attachment to the pleasure and enjoyment, not the pleasure and enjoyment itself. It's the thirst for the pleasure and enjoyment, not the pleasure and enjoyment itself. So that's what it is. And so this is the origin of suffering. It's chasing after those things which give us pleasure, those things which we believe will make us happy, those things which we think we ought to be. That's what it is. Chasing after it, holding on to it, fear of losing it, and the fact that even when we have these things, they never really satisfy us. So I'm as those of you who know me well, I'm a chocolate addict. That's one of my things that gives me pleasure. And I know that I very much enjoy the flavour of chocolate, but if I eat a whole bar, it loses its enjoyment. The pleasure it gave me to begin with loses its enjoyment. So believing that these things will keep on giving us pleasure, we can become addicted to them in some way. But they never really fully satisfy. They never really fully satisfy this sense within us of imperfection. And the option, the things that we can be attached to in this way vary from person to person. We all are attached in some way to life, but we each are attached in a different way. And we must observe the way that we are attached for ourselves. Someone else can't say how we are attached. We must observe in ourselves through the awareness that comes from practice, through the awareness that comes from regularly sitting. Then we can observe the way that the thirst manifests itself in us. And for some people, it can be sensory pleasures. I'll give the example for me. Chocolate does it for me sometimes. So it can be sensory pleasures, looking at trying to find pleasure, sensory enjoyment in life. For some people, it can be accumulation of things, money, wealth. So for some people, it's having more money, having the trappings of wealth around us. For some people, it can be ambition, power. It might be power, desire to have power over people, or it might be the desire for status. So all these things can, again, trap us. And even it says in Buddhism, and in fact, our Jean Bavie, who was one of the founders of this dojo and the founders of our school of Zen in the UK, even understanding the desire for knowledge, the desire for understanding and the desire for knowledge can trap us. So he used to say, because when he would give teaching, people asked him about studying the sutras, and he said that having knowledge of the teachings, etc., is a good thing. He said it's a kind of wealth. It's like a kind of wealth. But ultimately, the goal of practice is not to get wealth. That's not the goal of practice. So we can be, in the same way that we can be attached to money or to power or to sensual pleasures, we can be attached to knowing more about Buddhism, excuse me, or knowing more about anything. And so it's important to observe how these things manifest in ourselves and being aware that watch the way the first manifests in ourselves. And it doesn't mean you stop necessarily stop doing. It means you need to take some distance from it. And sometimes it's necessary to stop doing that thing, the thing that necessary to cut the thing that you chase after. Sometimes it's possible to take a different relationship with it. So the thing about these desires is that they can create conflict. They can create conflict within ourselves, and they can create conflicts between us and others. There can be small conflicts, there can be big conflicts. And the Buddha says that desire leads to anger. And I was listening to my boy was watching Star Wars, and apparently Yoda also says desire leads to anger. So, so the Buddha said that desire leads to anger. Basically, the conflicts that come with our desire for the world to be as we want it to be lead to anger. And again, to quote from Jean Babi, one of the founders of this centre, he used to say that wars are not fought by evil people, they're fought by good people who want to impose their idea of good on someone else. So people that you don't go into war thinking I'm an evil person, you think you know what's right for other people. And you try to impose your ideas on others. So again, it's the idea of that by being attached and strongly committed to what we believe is right, whether it's for ourselves or for others, we can cause suffering. And one of the things that Zen teaches is that we need to be able to observe this in ourselves. It doesn't mean we don't take a stand, but we need to be able to observe this in ourselves and be able to let go of the desire to impose what we believe is right on others. And the final thing that the Buddha said with regard to the origin of this suffering is that it comes from ignorance, avidya. And the avidya, again, something I touched on earlier, is avidya, ignorance of the impermanent nature of life, the fact that there is we cannot impose some kind of structure on life, which will always be there. You know, anything that we attach ourselves to will always go. And as I said earlier, we might intellectually be able to accept that, but it's really, do we have a visceral feel for it in us? And I think, if we're completely honest, I think all of us, maybe we get moments of that, but there are times also when we don't have a visceral feel, when we believe that the schemes that we create will last forever. And so what the Buddha is saying, effectively, is that those schemes, you've got to play the game of life. The game of life is there to be played. But when you play it, don't take it too seriously. Don't take the schemes that you create too seriously. So those are the first two truths. The first truth which makes us noble is our life has suffering in it. It has, at its core, dissatisfaction. And can we observe this dissatisfaction in us and how it manifests us? And the second truth is where this dissatisfaction comes from. It comes from how we create a fixed view of reality, how we want reality to be. We thirst for reality to be like that. And the more that we impose our view on reality, how we want it to be, the more we suffer. And then the third noble truth of the Buddha is that there is a way beyond this suffering, and which the Buddha uses the word nirvana, which is the extinction. And it's the extinction of thirst. So nirvana is the extinction of the thirst for things to be different. It also can be described as the uprooting of attachment, the uprooting of the attachments that we have to things. And this is interpreted in different Buddhist schools in different ways. And the way that we in Zen see it, in Soto Zen, and in fact one of the seven calligraphies up there says it says Bono Soku, it says practice and enlightenment is not different. We don't see it as something that is far outside us, that we work to achieve. We see it as something that is always already present in our existence as it is now. So even though we suffer, there is always a part of us which does not suffer. And the part of us that does not suffer is the part that we experience when we let go of the mind which create schemes and categories, etc. So it's always this part of us which doesn't suffer, the part of us which is enlightened or awakened, is always already present within us. And we experience it. It's not something that you wait for a long time to experience. It's something that you experience just for moments in practice. It's always there, just for moments. And with time, those moments can come more often. They can be a source of inspiration for your life. You'll always have work to do from the point of view of our school. It's never a kind of moment that suddenly everything's okay. As long as you're alive, there's going to be problems. But the moments of letting go that come in practice are a source of inspiration which gives us the strength to be able to let go in daily life when it's appropriate, and play the games that we play more skillfully and with less attachment, less anxiety. And the other thing to say about that is that the nature of those moments, they are, so I've read a modern kind of Zen-inspired, it's actually not psychotherapy, but rather a kind of self-help book, Zen-inspired, but it uses quite a nice way of describing this. It describes the doing mind versus the being mind. And the being mind is what we contact in Zen, the big mind. And the big mind, the being mind, lets go of all categories, just for a moment. So it doesn't try to analyse or categorise. It doesn't try to say what is good or what is bad. It lets go of that. And that act of letting go of what is good, what is bad, or even, you know, that those are categories which, you know, are good and bad, but just letting go of the need to label the sounds that go by. There's a truck. Letting go of all that. Letting go of the desire to make sense of the world for a little while. And just simply being present in the moment, experiencing it as it is for us nirvana. But it's something that you come in and out of. It's not something that ever is there permanently. And it's also something, as I said before, that can shine through your everyday actions, that can shine through and inspire the games that we play. And again, this is something that there's another Buddhist teacher, Mahayana teacher, called Nagarjuna, who used the expression samsara is nirvana, which translates effectively, the world, everyday world that we're in, is also the world of freedom, liberation. And so it's as I said before when I was speaking in a previous talk, it's like a one of those pictures that sometimes looks like a candlestick, sometimes looks like two people about to kiss themselves. Life is like that. That the same situation is both riddled with suffering and imperfection, and also at the same time can be a source of freedom and joy, just by finding that space within us and letting go of that. And so obviously some situations are harder than others, there's no doubt about it. Some situations are harder than others. But nonetheless, from the Buddha's point of view, any situation, no matter how extreme, it is possible to let go, be present, and experience existence beyond suffering in that moment, even though part of us may suffer deeply in that moment. So that's the third noble truth, that there is an end to suffering. And as I say, from the Zen point of view, that end is always already present in us in every moment, and we can taste it through practice. The fourth noble truth is the way to which leads us to that experience, and the primary, from our point of school, the primary practice for this is the practice of Zazen, seated Zazen. But the Buddha talks about the eightfold path, of which one of those is Dhyana, the practice of Zazen. And I'm not going to talk about that now, but in a later talk, I will talk about the Eightfold Path and what the Buddha said and how we experience it in Zen practice. So thank you very much for that.